Today is October 21st, 2006, and this is the Weekly Roundup, a Mac Observer podcast. I'm Ricky Spiro.
And I'm Jeff Gamet. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup.
This week, we'll take a quick look at corporate boo-boos, from pre-installed viruses to detonating batteries. We're also going to take another crack at our in-depth product roundup, so stay tuned. But let's start with some news.
Far less than 1% of the video iPods Apple shipped after September 12, 2006, contained a Windows virus known as RavMonE.exe. Greg Joswiak, Apple's vice president of worldwide iPod marketing, has said a Windows computer on the iPod production line apparently caused the infections. Fewer than 25 iPods have been affected. Oops.
This bit of malware is specifically called a worm. It propagates over mass storage devices like external hard drives and flash pen drives. It should be detected and zapped by any antivirus software with up-to-date definitions.
And while RavMonE.exe doesn't affect Mac OS X, it will, of course, infect Windows running on an Intel-based Mac via Bootcamp, Parallels, or similar software.
Apple isn't alone with this problem, by the way. Apparently some 10,000 MP3 players given away by McDonald's in Japan are infected by a worm that can steal personal data. Those MP3 players were only given away in Japan. And speaking of oops...
Yeah, Sony on Tuesday said that it will recall 90,000 Vaio laptop batteries in Japan and China, bringing the total batteries being recalled by the company to nearly 8 million. Between that and a price cut for the upcoming PlayStation 3 video game console, it said on its website that it may have to change its earnings forecast.
They may have to change their diapers. Dell, Apple, Lenovo, IBM, Toshiba, Hitachi, Fujitsu... all of them are currently taking part in a worldwide laptop battery recall, which is the largest of its kind ever to affect consumer electronics. TMO has covered this story in pieces over the past weeks. I've linked to some of those stories in the show notes.
And though we won't talk about it much this week, we're also linking to TMO's full coverage of Apple's fourth quarter financial results. Ricky did a show a little while ago on Mac market share, and one of our articles points out that Apple captured 6% of the U.S. market last quarter. Also of interest, Dell has fallen to second place in market share by volume. HP took the top spot last quarter.
And for those who want some idea of just how big a company Apple has become, its annual revenue this year was $19.3 billion. In the previous year, the largest of the tech firms, IBM, had an annual revenue of $91 billion. Or you can look at the overall Fortune 500 list and you'll see Apple held the 15th spot last year. This year's revenue is sufficient to put it at spot number 11. And for point of comparison, ExxonMobil holds the number one spot with annual revenue of $340 billion. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time in the context machine, Jeff, talking about these screw-ups. We just mentioned these two quick stories about Apple and the viruses on iPods and Sony and the battery recalls, and it's, of course, not just affecting Sony. First of all, this is a question about screw-ups in general. How do they happen functionally? I mean, these are big companies. There are a lot of people that put these production lines together. It sounds like in the case of the Apple thing, it was just a computer on the production line that had a virus and was somehow giving it to the iPods. In the battery case, it's actually quite extraordinary. There was some design flaw, apparently, that causes these things to burst into flames. And people have probably read about the actual, you know, the recalls and the fact that these batteries are being recalled in the mainstream media a lot. But how does this happen? How does this ever come to pass?
Well, actually, I think you hit on the point in the first part of your question when you noted that we're talking about really big companies with lots of people. And these companies have very complex product design, assembly, and production lines. So at some point, no matter how hard you try, you're going to end up with a flaw that gets in the system. It might be a transient thing, which is what it looks like in the case of the iPod, where a very small number of units, like 25 or so, made it through the system with this virus on them. Or you could have something where it's a little more widespread. And when I say a little more widespread, I probably should say insanely more widespread when you look at the case of Sony's batteries. As far as Apple goes, I think this is most likely just some minor aberration that happened in the entire assembly process, and is something that you can bet they've already patched up and will never happen again. In the case of Sony, however, I think it might be more along the lines of, we had a lot of people looking at a lot of spreadsheets and found enough places that on paper they could save some money. And in that process, they introduced a design flaw into their batteries. And now we have cases of Hindenburgs all over the world.
So the conventional wisdom here when it comes to the battery recall, and we should probably talk about the battery recall explicitly for a second. The conventional wisdom you're saying is that this was a series of development decisions in the interest of cutting costs or in the interest of making something efficiently. They didn't focus on safety as much as they could have. Is that what the standing assumption is?
That's what it looks like. Now, keep in mind that there's no one from Sony calling me to say, hey, Jeff, here's exactly what went on. But it looks like that's a pretty safe bet.
All right. So I also want to ask you, what do you want to see happen here? If someone, let's say that there's a problem with a product, whether it's something minor like a virus on an iPod, or some people might say the face of an iPod scratches more easily than it's supposed to, or in the case of Sony with these batteries, what's the appropriate course of action? What is the company supposed to do?
Well, I think it would be nice to see companies step back and say, okay, we're getting complaints, or we found an issue. Let's figure out what's really going on. And then based on that, let's take whatever the appropriate action is.
And which might be recalling, and it might be modifying the product somehow.
Exactly. And if they take a proactive approach to doing this, even if they have a problem that looks pretty bad, a company can really approach that positively and fix things quickly. And let's use the batteries as an example. As soon as Apple knew that there was a potential problem with the batteries that they had put into a specific range of iBook and PowerBook, they started their own study to figure out if there was an issue they needed to be concerned about. And before anyone else could step forward and say, people, you really have to do something, our laptops are blowing up, Apple had already issued a recall and had everything in place, and it looked really good for them, even though they have laptops that could potentially catch on fire.
So make it look like you caught it first and were the first to do something about it, and then it becomes a nice PR boost instead of a PR problem.
Absolutely.
So that would be the right way to do it. There's an obligatory question here. Who's done it? Who's done it poorly? Are there firms? Are there stories that are in the canon that people who were curious about recalls should know something about? I mean, particularly bad examples of corporate behavior under these circumstances?
Well, it's okay. If we look at Lenovo or IBM's laptop computer line, which is now part of Lenovo, they said, we don't have any problems. We're leaving this alone. Well, now they've had to reverse that, and they're part of Sony's battery recall. What would have been nice is if the company had come out at the beginning and said, yep, we've done our research also, and we think we need to do a recall. And my guess is that some of the companies involved in the recalls might be recalling batteries that otherwise are probably fine, but they're just being safe. Because it's a lot cheaper when you look at things from the lawsuit perspective to do something a little more aggressive in the beginning, like maybe recall some batteries that otherwise wouldn't need to be in that batch, as opposed to dealing with a big class action lawsuit down the road.
Fair enough. Now, here's a question. Should consumers ever root for a recall? I mean, has there ever been a circumstance where consumers are better off because product has been recalled?
Oh, sure. There's plenty of cases. And, well, in this battery situation is a perfect example. There's a lot of batteries out there that have a serious known flaw, and they need to be recalled. And thankfully, finally, it looks like all of them are being recalled. The problem with this is that you have a lot of people that just don't care. Even though they really root for recalls, they don't follow through on what they need to do, which is to swap out their battery. So even though we have the recall in place and things are being swapped out, we're going to have a lot of people out there with potentially dangerous batteries. And I think people, though, are more inclined to actually participate in a recall when it's actually more physically appropriate for them. In the case of over-the-counter drugs, as an example, when you see a company that decides they need to recall their painkiller medication because there was some defect in the manufacturing, you'll see people running to the store to return their Tylenol or Advil or whatever it happens to be. But you don't see them doing that with batteries that could potentially burn their lap off.
All right. Well, and the other thing that will be interesting to watch as this develops, there's a lot of discussion in laptops, in many other kinds of technology, portable technology, about what's going to happen next with batteries. One of the issues here, as far as batteries are concerned, is that there doesn't seem to be new technology on the horizon for, the brand new breakthrough battery technology. Are we stuck with, is any of this going to be a problem going forward? Is there something fundamental about lithium ion technology, which is the technology in basically all portable device batteries, and even now in some battery powered cars that people are making? Is there any reason to believe that lithium ion technology in and of itself is unsafe or is unusually prone to problems like this, that is, lighting on fire?
I don't think so. I think the big problem in this case was the manufacturing process, because Sony did whatever they did to, I'm assuming, save money, and it introduced these extremely small metal fragments into the power cells, and that happened when the ends were being crimped and sealed. So in that case, what we had was a manufacturing defect as opposed to a product technology defect. So I think we're going to be okay with the batteries that we're using as long as companies make sure that they're manufacturing the products in a safe and responsible manner. So I don't see this like products from prior times when a good example, a crazy example. There was a time in our history when radium had been discovered and people didn't know what it did, but they thought it was really cool and was going to be helpful. So people were drinking water that had been infused with radiation because they thought it was good for them. Well, all of a sudden people are giving birth to sideshow freaks, and you're seeing all kinds of weird problems because of that. Okay, that was a product defect because they simply didn't understand, in this case, what the technology was that they were playing with. What we're dealing with now, I think, really is just a situation of one company not following the proper procedures to safely develop a product.
Fair enough. And radium, for anyone that is following along at home, radium is one of the radioactive elements in the periodic table. It's an element. It happens to be radioactive, and you don't want to eat it.
No, you don't want to eat it. Although there was a time when you could buy it mail order so you could eat it.
I have actually, I've seen some of those ads. I forget where I was reading about it, but I have seen some of those ads from whatever it was, the 40s, 30s. So I think Google is telling me that it's atomic number 88 for any radium fans out there.
Go Radium.
So I guess that'll be the last word on that quick little context machine this week. Just taking a look at that stuff, and hey, we should move on to the onto the product roundup.
Well, for this week's product roundup, we're starting in on what will be a recurring feature on podcasting equipment. We know a lot of you kind listeners are podcasters yourself, and we get questions from you about the setup we have over here. So this week, we'll start off with an overview of types of recording equipment, and then talk briefly about this fancy mic I have sitting in front of me right now.
So let's get into it. There are going to be three general things. The first thing I'm thinking we should do is talk a little bit about recording equipment, the actual hardware and software that's involved. And so maybe we should go about this talking a little bit about the general pieces of equipment that you nominally hook up to a computer in order to do this kind of recording, just to make sure we're all on the same page with what various pieces of hardware are called and what they do. So, Jeff, I don't know where you want to start here.
Well, do you want to start with the hardware we're using or the software?
Why don't we start with software? Just briefly, I guess I can explain the recording setup that I have over here. So many of you may already know the way we record the show. Jeff is two time zones away from me, so we both get on Skype, and I record the entire show at my end. And for any of you who are familiar with some of the software involved here, or any of you who are listeners to the Mac Geek Gab, Dave and John did a show a while ago on their recording setup, and they explained to everyone how they use Audio Hijack Pro, which is this fantastic application from Rogue Amoeba Software, which is like the Swiss Army knife of core audio. It's the thing that lets you do anything, route any signal into any other place, and do all these very clever things with audio. They actually record their show, the Mac Geek Gab, with Audio Hijack Pro. I just use it to take all of the different audio sources that I have and pipe them into an application called Logic Pro. And Logic is Apple's. It was originally designed by a company named eMagic that Apple bought several years ago, and it's now the pro recording application that Apple sells for all kinds of audio recording, music recording, and mixing and editing, and work with MIDI and all different things. So it's a full blown professional audio recording system. It's not designed for podcasting, but I happen to have it and like it, and I like using it. So that's actually where I record all of this show. So that's just a quick look at the software. And if you're curious about that software, of course, the links to those are up in the show notes.
Right. And then for people that would prefer to not have to spend a lot of money to get into podcasting software, GarageBand has some podcasting features built into it. So you can hop right into that and start making podcasts without any major headaches.
And that's great. GarageBand is great if you want, like I do, to have the option of cutting up the show or changing things. Like, for example, when we record the show, the two of us just sit down and talk through the show. But if we have a context machine where someone else comes on, we record our bit, and then we go and we do the context machine with other people, and then we got to fit that into the rest of the show. So we do a little bit of cutting and pasting occasionally if the need arises. And GarageBand is great for that. If you just want to record live, if you just want to hit record and go, Audio Hijack Pro is a terrific application. And it's I'm actually not sure what the price is off the top of my head, but it's reasonably priced. I mean, it's certainly not a difficult thing to get a hold of. So yeah, both of those applications definitely are great. Yes. Applications to work with.
Okay, so now I guess we need to figure out how we're going to get the audio into the computer so Logic Pro can work with it.
Yeah, so this is the key word here. The key term is audio interface. And if any of you have spent any time talking to people that do recording, the audio interface is a big thing. It's the thing that allows you to get signals, analog signals from around the world, or digital signals that are outside of the Mac into the Mac. And the audio interface that I happen to use, again, this is a kind of a prosumer, more consumer end device. It's called an M-Audio Firewire 410. It's made by M-Audio, and they make some great hardware for recording. They make mics, they make a lot of mobile recording stuff. And anyway, so this Firewire 410, which is what I use, and that's the thing that takes the mic cable that comes out of my microphone. I plug my mic into that, and it can route that. It just shows up as an audio input device, and Audio Hijack Pro can grab that signal and send it to Skype so that Jeff can hear me, and can send it to Logic so that Logic can record me. So that's my audio interface. M-Audio does a great job. My biggest complaint about them is that they tend to take a while to upgrade their or update their drivers whenever operating systems change or other things. But by and large, I mean, it's a solid piece of hardware, and it does the job right. It's got phantom power, so I can use condenser mics. We'll talk about that in a second. It's got a lot of outputs, so I've used it to do some clever audio routing stuff. But yeah, so it's a solid piece of hardware. I'm not wedded to it. I don't think it's the greatest thing in the world, but it certainly works. It does the job. It's a nice workhorse, and I'd recommend it. Again, a kind of prosumer level thing. I think it's about $200. I'd have to go double check that, but I think it's about $200.
Right, and if you don't want to spend that $200-ish dollars, M-Audio makes some other great products that connect via USB. So you can still get your Phantom Power and have a few other breakout connectors without having to spend more than $100, $150, depending on what you need.
Yeah, and for podcasting, usually because you downcode stuff so much, you don't need to worry a lot about the sound, the actual quality of the audio interface itself. If you're doing music stuff, if you're trying to record yourself for a band or music, then it becomes a little bit more sensitive to the quality, the audio quality of the audio interface, how well it encodes the audio and stuff like that. But that's not so much of an issue for podcasting, so we'll kind of leave that aside for now.
Okay, and then I guess it's on to microphones. And I'll start by saying people have been able to hear my voice at a lot of different quality levels, because I so far have tried a fairly wide range of microphones, ranging from experimenting with a Jabra Bluetooth headset, which made me sound like I was on a satellite phone in Bosnia. I've also experimented using the microphone built into an EyeSight camera, and I've also played with Plantronics headsets to see how they perform as well.
So that's also, if you go back and listen to the times when Jeff has been on the show, either when he was a co-host or earlier when he was in the Context Machines, his voice sounds like all kinds of different things. What we're doing now, and the reason that we're talking about this, we're starting to get in some product from different places on podcasting equipment that we're considering using at our end. And so, like we were saying last week, we're thinking we wanted to explain to you what we were doing. So as our voices changed and as the sound of the show changed over and over again, you had some idea what we were doing and could kind of play along as we're going through this. So that everyone's on the same page here with microphones, the types of microphones we're going to be talking about, and the two types of microphones, if you're a podcaster or interested in starting podcasting, the types of mics that you're going to decide between, the two big categories are dynamic mics and condenser mics. I'll put a Wikipedia link in the show notes.
Did
on
I
microphones.
Lose you?
Yeah, I mean it's a very complete discussion of the various types of microphones. And if you're curious about some of the technical things that go into making a microphone work, they do a pretty good job with that there as well. But the basic distinction is this. Dynamic mics tend to be much more rugged. They tend to handle loud volumes really well. So if you have something that suddenly gets really loud, a dynamic mic can clamp down on that loud sound without peaking out, without buzzing and making weird sounds. The problem with dynamic mics is that they require a lot more technique. So, for example, I've been moving around a lot while I've been talking today, but you notice that as I move around my microphone, all of a sudden I start to disappear in weird ways, and so I can kind of phase in and out of sound. That was probably not terribly pleasant to listen to. I apologize. But the depending on where you are on your microphone, if it's a dynamic mic, it's going to be very sensitive to your position on the mic. And so getting a good, consistent sound requires a little bit more technique. So that can be a little daunting if you've never sat in front of a microphone before. It can kind of do weird things to your mind when you try and start talking into it. Condenser mics, the thing about condenser mics, they're really sensitive. They require this thing called phantom power, which allows them to, they can also be called capacitor mics, and it keeps that capacitor charged, that phantom power. But they require a lot less technique. That's the nice thing about them, and they're really sensitive. They pick up everything. And so when you're in studios, when you're doing really high-quality audio recording, people tend to use condenser mics, but that's because they can control the levels really well and they know exactly what's happening. The problem with them for podcasting is that they pick up everything. So if you're not working in a really nice studio, you're going to hear your air conditioner running. You're going to hear, you know, the door slam three rooms away when you're using a condenser mic. So that's kind of the general trade-off. Now, Jeff, you're actually holding on to a condenser mic right now, right?
Yes. Yes, the Samson C03U.
Now, so you just got this mic last week. We mentioned that you had it on the show. Tell us a little bit about this thing. What is the CO3U? Like, what does it look like? What is it?
Okay, this microphone looks like what you'd expect. It's a long barrel, and then it has the mesh screen over the top. And if you've ever seen or been into a recording studio where you see people with the booms and the mics hanging down in front of them, that's a lot what this looks like. The interesting thing about this condenser mic is that I don't have to use a breakout box with it because it has all of the circuitry built into the microphone handle. So the phantom power that it's getting is being powered directly from a USB port. So this microphone is connected directly to my computer through a USB port, which is actually a really neat thing.
Just so that everyone understands what that means, I was talking about two different pieces of hardware, right? The microphone and the audio interface. And what they've done, Samson has done a really interesting thing. They've gone and they've built the audio interface into the microphone. So there's no cable that you plug into an audio interface and then have to get drivers for the audio interface and everything. You just plug this USB cable directly into the thing. The USB cable connects to the mic and it just shows up, I understand, on your Mac. Tell us a little bit about the installation here. How did that go? How much work did you have to do to get it to turn on and work?
Well, I had to plug it in. And there's no step two. I mean, seriously, that was it. I plugged it in. My Mac said, oh, you have a Samson microphone and you can use it as an input. Great, there you go. And that was it. What took a lot longer was when I realized I didn't have a boom mic stand that I was going to be able to mount the microphone in. So I had to make a trip to my local guitar center and buy something. And that took substantially longer than anything else.
Now, the stand that you put it on, was that a standard stand? I mean, when you showed up and said, I have this microphone, I want to put it on a stand, was it the normal stand connection?
Yes, absolutely. It's totally a normal microphone stand, completely standard. The one that I picked up was, it's a little desktop microphone boom stand, and it's like a $50 stand, and I just happened to go in on the right day, and it was $30. The thing that threw the people when I got there was that my microphone had a smaller connection point on the tail end of it where you would actually screw the microphone in. And let me correct that. The adapter that the microphone uses to attach to the stand that had a smaller opening to screw into, and that threw the people for a minute until I pointed out we can actually unscrew that. So what the deal is, it shipped with a built-in adapter for the European size boom mics or boom stands. you unscrew that, and then it's the American standard for the boom stands. So you can use it pretty much anywhere you want, as long as you remember to either put the adapter in or take it out.
And for those of you who might have never been to the United States, the guiding rule here is we like things to be bigger.
Yeah.
Under all circumstances. So tell me about how you like this thing. I mean, do you like using it? How has it been? You're coming from using a headset, which it, from the perspective of the audio people, it's like you've just come in from the cold. You've just come in from a war zone. You're now actually using a microphone, a real microphone. And I think that you're actually in the position, many of our listeners who may have started podcasting or who are looking at podcasting are probably very much in your position where they say, well, I don't know how to do this, or I've never done it, or I'm kind of curious to try this. How do you feel when you're sitting in front of it, listening to yourself? Is it worth the $130 that this mic costs?
If you want to sound good when you're podcasting, I'd say it's totally worth the investment. And it was amazingly easy to install and use. So that part of it is really nice, because there's so many other aspects when you're a new podcaster that can suddenly become overwhelming. You know, how do you get everything edited? How do you get all the pieces together? How do you set it up with an RSS feed so people can subscribe to it and get it on the iTunes store? With a microphone like this, you don't have to worry about those other things, along with how do I make my microphone work?
Yeah, so you can focus really on nice the thing. Actual starting the podcast rather than getting equipment. The other thing I want to point out, my understanding about the CO3U. Now, Samson makes CO1, CO2, CO3. Those are all microphones that it makes. The U that is appended to the name is the thing that refers to USB, that this is a USB-capable microphone,
right,
or that it's a USB interface. The CO3U is the big brother of the CO1U, which I think is about $80, and that is missing some of the little switches and knobs on your microphone. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened when you got this thing out of the box and saw these knobs?
Well, when I pulled it out of the box and I saw that there's these switches on it, my first thought was, crap, what does this do? Where's the power button? And then I thought, well, wait, I'm a Mac user. I'm used to plugging things in and they just work. So let's see what happens. And lo and behold, it just worked. The nice thing is this microphone out of the box has all the switches in the right place for like 95% of the people. So that was really nice. The bonus is that you can use this microphone in a different fashion from the way I'm using it, where right now I have it so it's positioned in front of my face and I'm talking directly into it, and it's picking up the sound just from the direction I'm facing. I can switch this so it's picking up the sound from in front or behind of the microphone, which in this case would be bad because that would mean that the audio would bounce off of my display and back into the microphone and you'd start getting some weird sounds. But the point is, this microphone has the flexibility to be used the way I'm using it, or to be used in an environment where you need to pick up all the sound around you.
And just in case these come up in future shows, the relevant terms here are cardioid, which is a directional microphone. If something has a cardioid pattern, so when you talk about a microphone, you talk about the pattern, the pickup pattern of the microphone. What's the pattern in front of the mic where it picks up sound? If it's cardioid, it's picking up directionally straight ahead of the microphone, which is how I understand you have it set up now. There's bidirectional.
Right.
In the case of this microphone, it can pick up from the front or the back, and it can also be switched to omnidirectional, so it picks up equally in a circle. And so all of those things, those are the patterns, the pickup patterns. This $80 version of this same microphone, which I think has all the same electronics in it and the same element, so this the same pickup element, so that the audio quality should be just as good, it doesn't have those switches for direction, which is the primary thing that you lose going to CO1 rather than the CO3U.
Right, and if you're just doing a podcast where you're going to be set up the way I have the microphone right now, that's not a big deal. But if you need to have flexibility with the way you're going to be doing recordings, then you might want to spend the extra money to get the CO3U.
Right on. So that's just kind of a quick look at that stuff. And the next time we talk about microphones, we won't do all that backstory. We'll just jump into it and talk about what patterns things have and whether it's dynamic or condenser. But I figured maybe we should go through all of that once so we're all on the same page. And as stuff comes in, we'll switch. And if you hear, hey, wait, you sound different this week, that's probably what's going on. So all of that is just for background, and hopefully some of you find that useful, and we'll keep on this as the weeks go by.
Yes, and so far I really like this microphone, but I'm also really looking forward to trying out some of the other products just to see how they stack up. And that's the news. Thanks for listening to Weekly Roundup.
Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom for TMO. And once again, that is all that I've got at this end.
And as always, stay subscribed.
Until next week, everyone, we'll see you online.